Do I have sound? Check one, two. Yeah, looks like I do. So, this is history reimagined. It will be in a few minutes at least. I'm going to just set things up now. It looks like if we've got sound, that's definitely a good start. Assuming that the show's going to happen this week. Assuming Chris hasn't got some issues or whatever, but we'll find out as we go along. What I'm going to do is play a little bit of Redacted just to get us started until Chris arrives. So this is from last week. And the title of it is, Why Are They Hiding This About Klaus Schwab and the WEF? So it's a little bit of Klaus Schwab history.
Well, Klaus Schwab's World Economic Forum is underway right now in Davos, Switzerland. The globalists meeting to decide how they will control you for the next decade or so of your life, or maybe even the next 100 years. But who is Klaus Schwab? The man that sits at the helm of the World Economic Forum, the WEF. Well, investigative journalist Johnny Vedmore has spent a long time investigating Klaus Schwab, and he joins me now. And Johnny, as we were talking here before the show, I mean, it's not just about Klaus Schwab. These tentacles are deep and they are wide. What made you start investigating Klaus Schwab?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Clayton. Me and my girlfriend Whitney, we were sitting around the coffee table in Chile, and we were looking for information on him. And Whitney said to me, "Why don't you investigate Klaus Schwab? You go back in the time through the elites of history. Why don't you look? Because there's nothing out there about him," which is in great contrast to what is now. And I feel that's really affected by the information I found, because everything had been scrubbed online, and that intrigues any investigative journalist. And I love going back through history. So I went back as far as I could. I started backwards from Schwab's in the past, because so much had been deleted. There's no point in going back through time. You have to start already in history and look at all of the Schwabs. So basically I spent 4 to 5 weeks just searching every Schwab in history in Germany and their ancestors. And I eventually found Klaus Schwab's ancestors, his father, his mother, his grandfather, and an amazing story surrounding it. An amazing story. Klaus Schwab, his father was Eugen Schwab, born 1898, and eventually when he was older he would work for a Nazi model company called Escher Weiss, and during the war Escher Weiss would be central to the Nazi atomic bomb program, and so Klaus Schwab's father, who was managing director of the main factory in Ravensburg, was not only making submarine parts and aircraft parts for the Nazis, and potential atomic bomb casings for the Nazis as well. They were also making the large turbines that would power the heavy water hydroelectric dams that they normally built them for. It was the same way they enriched uranium for their type of process of atomic bomb making. And so he was a very important man, Eugen Schwab. Of course, the Nazis weren't successful. When Klaus was growing up, Germany was being it was trying to change its image to the rest of the world. They were trying to say, look at us, we're now kind, we got over it. And at the same time, America was kind of learning some of the tools that the Nazis had used. The American intelligence services were using some of those tools to kind of do the same tricks the Nazis were pulling in attempt to fight communism, you know, for a good aim. They were saying, we're going to fight back these Soviets. Before it, we start need to get dirty. And they started, of course, we know Operation Paperclip. They started bringing people in. And there was lots of projects set up. And in 1950, there was a special project set up in Harvard called Kissinger's International Seminar. It was actually set up by William Yandel Elliott, a grandee of American politics, who basically had been advised to six different presidents throughout his career as a high-ranking CFR member. And he invented this seminar, which a newly graduated Kissinger was put in charge of, and it was about training young global leaders. And in 1964, Eugen Schwab, Klaus Schwab's father, would say to Klaus, the only place you're going to go to succeed in the world now is Harvard. And he went and got offered a place, because you didn't apply for Kissinger's International Seminar. You were often headhunted. You could apply, but only the best got in. And they were looking for the best potential young leaders. And Klaus Schwab, in 1965, joined the ranks of Kissinger's International Seminar, which he graduated in 1967, and was a CIA-funded course. On the year Klaus Schwab graduated in 1967, Humphrey Dorman of Harvard released in the New York Times and another newspaper of the information that the Kissinger's International Seminar had been funded between 1960 and 1966 by the CIA through American Friends of the Middle East, which was set up by Kermit Roosevelt, the Farfield Foundation, and the Asian Foundation. Wow. So Klaus Schwab had just gone through a CIA-funded course in Harvard. He was given, during that course, two mentors, really fantastically interesting and important people in history, one being Herman Kahn, who's described as a real Dr. Strangelove, and is a guy you want to explore in detail, and John Kenneth Galbraith, another grandee of American politics, who was a teacher of JFK. JFK made him ambassador to India, wanted him to be ambassador to the Soviet Union. So, you know, saw him in that sort of, held him in that sort of regard. And John Kenneth Galbraith has one of the most amazing histories around. And John Kenneth Galbraith,
all right, I'm going to pause Johnny Vedmore there, so I think Chris is available. So, Chris, if you want to jump on, I'll accept you. Let me invite you up. There we go. Invite. And we'll see how this goes. It's the first show, so we'll work out how it all happens. As we go along, it'll be interesting. There we go.
Thank you, Dennis. I'm live. I was just transmitting, getting the copying the picture so that you can show them that snapshots onto the briefing. And I've got about a third of them done. I need a few more minutes. So I was going to continue with Klaus Schwab. For just a couple minutes, and then you'll have this. So this will be complete. The audience will be able to understand the subject of the essay is, this is going to blow the minds of everyone. The true city of Jerusalem and King Solomon's Temple was and is Edinburgh, Scotland, in southern Scotland. And this has been hidden by the elite. Predominantly Great Britain has controlled history for several thousand years, and in 800 AD, they rewrote history, stating that the Anglo-Saxons were the original founders of the British, and that was a complete falsity. Also, they actually came from Turkey, that Ireland and the British Isles, predominantly Ireland, then the British Isles, is the true foundation of Western civilization. This is a fact. Dennis and I will be briefing and showing you the knowledge of the world that has been covered up for millennia. And you're going to see the man's name is, he's Scottish. And I will introduce him in a moment. But what I'm saying is that this is just absolutely fascinating knowledge. And I also have an essay that, not an essay, but rather an audio by a professor British professor, and his name is Alan Wilson, A-L-A-N-W-I-L-S-O-N. This is fascinating because he proved in 1994, he did 35 years of research, that the history of Great Britain has been absolutely rewritten and falsified. And he was either from Oxford or Cambridge. I don't want to misquote, but he was filmed by two other professors that are twins from the same school in front of their fireplace. So the image is not important. It's the message that he's stating. Now, this was produced over 27 years ago, and I'm sure he has passed on, but he left an incredible message in his audio. It's about 45 to 50 minutes, but it is absolutely spellbinding, because the public doesn't know that history has been rewritten and edited to the benefit of only the elite. All right. So, Dennis, if you can continue for a couple minutes so I can get this and send it to you. Images are typically JPEG, where we were taught that it meant like TIFF and GIF, other type of images. JPEG truly stands for John Paul Getty. Getty was one of the, essentially, the elite Illuminati, and all images are either his or subsidiary companies that were merged and bought out, whereby he controls the images of all your media today, not the actual text or the internet itself, but all the images. And once you control the images, we are a visual-oriented society, and you basically, without images, the public will not be able to recognize or even believe, because it is so important in our culture to actually have verifiable proof of what you're reading and what you're watching is actually the truth of life. Anyway, continue on for a moment, and I'll have the images sent to you in just a few minutes. Okay, Dennis?
All right, yeah, no worries, Chris. We'll just take our time and do what we need to do. So I'm going to play something else, because I've just realized that if I play Redacted on YouTube, I'll probably get done for copyright violation, so I'm going to play something else.
That's fine. I briefed in Canada, in Ontario, on Jeff Shepherd's Right on Radio for one entire year, and then he chose not to do live broadcastings with me. There was no animosity or any conflict. This is was his show, but what I can tell the audience is that these are his words, not mine. From February 1st to April 30th, in 3 months, I doubled his audience from 25,000 to over 50,000. Then I continued on until essentially November 1st, but there was at least 65. The audience, he is an American, and he lives in Ontario, Canada. However, of his audience, he gave me statistics, 74% of his live audience that are watching, and he also shares it on five other social media platforms like YouTube and others, that 74% were from the United States. Of that 74%, 70% were women. There were thousands that watched the shows, and they will come to this. This is the knowledge they want. So we will gain a large audience very, very shortly. Okay, Dennis, you go forward.
All right, I'll just pick something that hopefully doesn't get me copyright struck. So I'm gonna
mute myself, and then when I unmute, we'll be all set. But you'll have the photo, and that way you can share them with the audience.
Okay, no worries, that's fine, Chris. Don't worry. Let's have a little bit about the Reich machine. This is from BitChute, so how accurate it is, I don't know, but. We'll see what this guy has to say.
By the early 60s, we had captured a device. It was actually during the Vietnam era. We captured a Russian device called the LIDA machine, L-I-D-A, which was actually looked at by a guy named Ross Addy, one of the leading researchers, again, for military. He looked at this, and it was used for putting military prisoners of war into trance-like states using flickering lights and sound and electromagnetic field oscillations so that you would get in a very relaxed state, in a state where they could extract intelligence much more efficiently from you. And that became a whole new review for military technologists in this country, thinking maybe we can use electromagnetic fields to manipulate what's going on in the brain. In 1969, there was a book published called Towards a Psycho-Civilized Society, and this was put together by Jose Delgado, and he had his a doctorate in electrophysiology from the University of Madrid from 1950. He came over to Yale University in the mid-60s and began mapping the human brain, stimulating the human brain in primates and bulls and animals, all kinds of animals, stimulating different parts of the brain to see what parts were responsible for what kinds of actions or cognitive functions and so on. So what he was doing in those days, in the 60s, was he was implanting microcircuits, and then, or not microcircuits, circuits, and stimulating them with RF, radio frequency energy. So one of the illustrations or photographs shows a charging bull coming at him, and he throws the switch, and the bull stops right in front of him. Well, by the mid-80s, he figured out you didn't need any implanted technologies. All you needed to know was how to modulate the right frequency, and the energy density, the concentration of energy, was 1/50th of what the Earth naturally produces. Very small, small energy in the RF range, radio frequency ranges. Now, compare that to what's around us right at the moment. At the moment, there's 200 million times more radio frequency and energy around us in any urban area than there is produced by the Earth. So a huge amount, and out of all that background noise, what he found is by hitting a precise window frequency with very low energy concentrations, you would pick that signal out because it was coherent, not like nature all over the map. It was a coherent rhythmic signal in a very precise frequency. The brain would pick it out, and he could change behavior from lethargic to highly active, back and forth, like switching on and off a light switch.
Let me ask a question right here. Is that with a subject that was in, say, a short distance of whatever he was utilized to affect this particular pulse, or is this at large? Could he do this on, say, larger groups?
You could do it on an individual basis or a very large basis. In fact, if you go back to the work of J.F. Gordon MacDonald, he was a geophysicist at UCLA, and he was a science advisor to Lyndon Johnson. He wrote a chapter in a book called Unless Peace Comes, and the chapter was called How to Wreck Your Environment. Within that chapter was a section that said, if we could ever learn how to electronically stroke the ionosphere, this layer that begins about 30 miles above the Earth's surface that's electrically charged, if we could ever figure out how to electronically stroke it, he said, to get it to signal back to the Earth, we could affect the behavior of people over huge geographic areas on a hemispheric basis. And it wouldn't affect everyone. It would affect 70 or 80% of the population is what they more or less figured. But this was a technology that didn't exist in 1969. In the early 70s, Zbigniew Brzezinski referenced J.F. Gordon's work and said, you know, this is a technology that will likely emerge. What has happened with that I wrote a book on some time ago, Angels Don't Play This Harp, about the HARP project, it was designed to do many things. As a side effect or a deliberate effect, this can happen. You know, I mean, the fact is they generate the right kind of signal in the right range to override brain function. And that you can kind of look at the brain in sort of this way in terms of predominant brain activity. 1 to 4 hertz or pulses or vibrations per second. This is where you are in your deepest, deepest states of sleep. The next range, approximately 4 to 7 hertz. This is the theta range. This is where you are between awake and asleep when you're consciously aware of your dreams. This is where little kids are between 3 and 6 years old, why they have trouble distinguishing reality from imagination because of the way the brain works at that time. A little bit further up, you have the alpha range, 7 to, say, 11, 12 hertz in that range. This is where you are when you're in the zone, when you're doing your art, your reading, your research, when you're really focused. You know, that's where you want to be. And then above that is the beta range, is where people should be when we're actively having this kind of a dialogue. And then high beta is where you are in your agitated states. If you think about affecting the brain by analogy, similarly to dialing a radio station. You know, when you dial through the radio station, most of the energy is just static. Just your static between the stations. When you get on station, you get resonance, harmony between the transmitter and receiver, and you get a nice clear signal. The same is true in the human body and the human brain. Whether you look at it on an elemental level, the elements that compose the body, or you take it all the way up to the organs of the body, you can create modulations, oscillations, will override the brain's natural rhythms. The brain will entrain or lock on to that external signal and begin to mirror it.
By putting this coherent signal in.
Right. Coherent, meaning rhythmic, right. Not random.
Right.
And so it's not so much the amount of energy, it's the way the energy is manipulated.
All right, so that's just something I picked up randomly off BitChute to give us some time. So we're pretty much there, I think. Chris, are you with me, or are you still sending emails?
I'm finalizing it right now. About 1 minute and you'll have it, okay?
All right, I don't think he's ready yet, so I'll play a little bit of something else just to keep us going.
I want this to be correct.
So a bit random. I don't want to bring you YouTube's terms of service, but I'm going to pick something that looks mellow and also looks like it's probably not on YouTube, so that limits what I'm doing pretty much. Let's have a look. Right, let's try a little bit of Webster Tarpley.
Okay. Just about to send it.
It's from 1994. But it's new on BitChute, so let's see if it works. No, it doesn't look like that's going to happen. It's one of those things with BitChute. Sometimes they play it and sometimes they don't. So I will just carry on. Let me know when you're ready, Chris, and we'll just get moving with it. I'll have a look in my email and see if there's anything else. Come over.
Just type in your name with my one arm. Okay. Part one. No. File save. All right.
What I'm going to do is I'm going to share the email on YouTube.
You should be having it just about now. It takes about 5 to 8 seconds to transmit across the Atlantic in that range. These are just images because I already sent the essay before. And
so there we go. So I should be able to share the images.
Brandon Michael Keyes is the author of this. He is Scottish and he did incredible research. And for the audience purpose, we are only relaying the truths of life. These are facts, not fiction. I was an analyst in the military as well.
Really, so it looks like we're okay with that. I was a Federal
Defense Department. So I spent 28 years. Combined.
Chris, just let me know when you're ready and we'll get started. In the meantime, just talk amongst yourselves for a few minutes. I'll play some...
Did you get the essay?
I'll play some calming music. Let's see if I can find some royalty-free cheesy music.
I can start now. Ready, Dennis.
Just to keep us going. Right, and I've got no volume from the music, so I don't know why that would be.
Okay.
God, it's one of those things. Technology either works or it doesn't. Let's not worry about music.
Did you receive the photos?
All right, if you're ready, Chris, we can just carry on.
Yes. Did you receive all the images, the photos?
Are you with me? I'm not hearing you.
Oh.
All right, I'm still not hearing you here. So I don't know exactly what's going on. We'll figure it out, though. I could hear you a minute ago, and I don't know. I haven't changed anything, so I don't know what's going on. But we'll work it out. Let me... See if I can get Webster Tarpley to appear. This is going to be interesting, I think. It's going to be interesting. Tarpley's always quite good in his own way.
Shall we start? Look, I thought that I would try to provide some kind of overview of the proverbial 2,500 years of history. Because one of the things that Lynn is always saying is that you're not really capable of understanding what goes on around you from day to day unless you have a historical overview that contains at the minimum 600 or 700 years, that is, say, back to the Council of Florence in 1439. Or better, a longer historical overview reaching back 2.5 millennia. So this is what I wanted to try to do. And of course, the problem with that is, how do you fight yourself? How do you fight your way through that forest of detail? Right? I have my watch here. Of course, usually when giving these briefings, I'm reminded that there's a calendar on the wall behind me, even if my watch has stopped. But you see, that's the problem, and how to make sense out of all of stuff so that you get an idea of what actually happened in history.
All right, Chris.
Yes, this is very common. Yes. I'm just letting you know that don't be surprised if this happens during the show, throughout all the shows in the future. But the Deep State will do everything possible to block me from telling the truth to the audience. I've gone through this since I was a whistleblower since 1988. But the point is, this happens on every single show that I've been on. All the hosts like yourself understand this, and they realize that I have to reset. So this is just part of the process that I've had to tolerate for decades. But right now, I was on, but once everything is based, audience, on algorithms. It's all based on the computer, and once certain words come up, match, then they target those individuals. I've been one key one because I'm a nemesis. Basically, I'm one of the greatest nemesis to the New World Order. Okay, I'm ready to go.
All right.
Did you get the images that I sent?
I haven't. I've got the original email, and I've got images from that, and I can show those on YouTube.
Can you pull those off? Because I did one. What I did is I set one up that's strictly 4 years, and I'll reset it because I've got like about, I've had to put like 48 lines between each picture, and that way it ensures that it will be able to transmit because of what Jean-Paul Getty did. Okay, I'm going to set it again.
All right, I've got images of King Solomon's Temple and things like that. I can show those.
I'm sending it again so you actually have one strictly for photos. That's all it is.
All right. Fair.
They're in chronological order so that as you see a gap in the actual essay, that you just start from the top and sequentially Put them in.
The,
okay, here you go. Okay. And that way you will have a clear, strictly images. I've had to do this on every podcast I've been on because it's always, our internet is so corrupted that it's never going to get fixed. Okay, I'm sending it.
All right.
Okay, here you go.
Yeah, so
look now and you,
all right, so you have them. I've got images here. I'll share them on YouTube. So I won't probably share them on Podbean, but they'll be on the live broadcast because we're doing it on YouTube as well.
Okay. Well,
so it's just,
I got a black strike by Jeff Shepard, developed a site for all my essays because it only took 3 words of what I was saying for him to get a strike against him on YouTube. So you just need to be careful, but. These will broadcast on Podbean. That's what they've been used for, to post the images as I brief on the renditions I have prepared. So, okay, we can go forward from here.
All right, Jay, just carry on, and I'll do what I can with.
Yes, you look YouTube. In your email, and you should see a new essay. With just images. It's not script. It's just photos. And I sent it already. I have it by now.
Yeah, I've got it, Chris.
Okay, those are good.
Clear. Yeah, I've got it.
Okay, good. All right, we're set. I will start out on this minimizing so I can have more space here. All right, audience, we're covering one of the most important one within the top important. Five, top ten. Yes? Your voice is a little bit garbled. Try again.
Your voice is a little bit garbled. Try again.
No, that wasn't me. That wasn't me.
Oh, well, we're getting an echo coming back then. Okay. We'll see. I'm going to put the phone a little bit further away. All right. And that way.
Right, I'll turn the mic down.
Okay, that would be good. I'll do the same. I won't keep mine up at full volume because I'm over 50% deaf. All right, audience, we're covering our first essay. It's part one. And this is the true city of Jerusalem and King Solomon's Temple was and is still today Edinburgh in southern Scotland near the northern British border. Okay. And then it has the first picture with the pyramid, the temple, and the Sphinx. Okay. All right, and for some reason my didn't enlarged that I way ahead of it before, so I'm just enlarging the, there we go. Okay, let's do this. Okay, one moment. All right, wait one moment.
All right.
That one I sent, and the one before it. Moment, please. All right, this is good. Okay, we're set with this. All right. So, this is part one, and the public will actually learn that Jerusalem and King Solomon's Temple was never in what we know today as Palestine or Israel. And this is, I'm reading this, the true model of King Solomon's Temple. This is created by Brandon Michael Keyes, K-E-Y-E-S. He's Scottish. True model of King Solomon's Temple, created by Dr. John Wesley Kelchner, which is K-E-L-C-H-N-E-R, which is the most accurate model of the Temple of Solomon. This would be the most correct version of the temple itself. And he also says, by the way, King Solomon is my ancestor. The porches support your pillars. Give us a breakdown where you can show that that this relates to. The Portrait Pillars, north of Queen's Palace, was a famous Portrait Pillars. The monumental structure was erected in the honor of Milo, considered the most beautiful entrance to the citadel of King's Palace. A famous picture portrays as a prince, Milo, being received at this great portal. Important visitors such as kings, governors, potentates, and others of national and international standing, whom the king delighted to honor, were received at this gate. The Porch of Pillars consisted of 32 pillars, beautifully enabled and resting upon a foundation or platform 100 feet and 60 feet wide. And this is referenced in the Bible in Kings 7:6. The Porch of Judgment. Directly to the east, across an open space, was the Great Porch of Judgment. The Bible portrays a monumentous event. Solomon is on his throne, and on his right is his lifelong friend, Zabad, Zabod. And on his left, a scribe. Immediately in front of the scribe is the high priest. On the steps is an orator presenting the complaints of the princes of the tribes of Israel. On the right, in the front of the throne, a prophet of the desert dressed in leopard skin and carrying a shepherd's crook. So important was this meeting that Solomon called out his personal bodyguard. He is being condemned by the prophet as having wandered away from the faith of the true God. He has been condemned by the princes as having been squandered money in riotous living, meaning extravagance, overtaxing the people and causing universal complaints and threats of secession from the houses of Judah. That's referenced in Kings 7:10-18:19. The altar of burnt offerings, those are all part of the Temple of Solomon. The center of the eastern half, the inner court, stood the most indispensable part of the apparatus of worship. The altar of burnt offerings, made of brass, 20 cubits in length and 20 in breadth and 10 cubits in height. That translates, audience, into 50 feet long by 40 feet broad and 20 feet high. That's referenced in 2 Chronicles 4:1. The next item is the Molten Sea, M-O-L-T-E-N-S. The inner court of the southeastern corner stood the most striking of the creations of Solomon's Phoenician's artist, who was Hiram of Tyre. Okay, that's H-I-R-A-M of Tyre, which is T-Y-R-E. And that city was in what is today on the coast. But this was the Molten Sea. It was a large circular tank of bronze, 30 cubits in circumference, 5 cubits in diameter, and 5 cubits in height. This translates into 60 feet around, 20 feet across, and 10 feet high, with a brim thickness of a hand's breadth. These measurements show that Hiram, that's H-I-R-A-M, understood the principles of circular form and construction. The Great Sea rested on the backs of 12 bronze bulls, which in groups of three faced the four cardinal points. Being, and this is referenced in 1 Kings 7:23-27, 1 Chronicles 4:2-5. Next is the lavers, or the lavers, right? 10 lavers of brass raised upon wheels, used for washing the animals to be sacrificed in the burnt offering and in the general cleansing of the court after the services. Each was 4 cubits long, 4 cubits wide, and 3 cubits high, which translates to 8 by 6. The lavers, bases, and the wheels were highly ornamented, symbolically embellished with lions, oxes, cherubim, and palm trees. 5 of the lavers stood on the north side of the inner court and 5 on the south side. That's referenced in 1 Kings 7:27-39. And then it shows an image from the front in gray of what the Temple of Solomon looks like.
and that's a restoration by John Wesley Kelsner. Okay. Then the next image is a side view with a light green color and a black background. This palace was the most grandest temple anywhere. And then it shows the front from the left side front. And we go on with the Great Porch. The Great Porch, these are all aspects of the temple. It's just that fascinating. Monumental. The Great Porch was a monumental structure, 120 cubits high, which is 240 feet, built over the entrance of the sanctuary. This entrance or vestibule was 20 feet long and 10 cubits broad, which is 40 by 20. Through this porch, the priests were admitted to the sanctuary, and that is also referenced in 2 Chronicles, 3:4, and 1, and also in 1 Kings 6:3. The two pillars of brass. Standing in relief that formed an important feature in the architecture of the temple. Each one was 25 cubits high, 12 cubits in. That is that is 70 feet tall by 20 feet tall. They were highly ornamented and by a network of brass, overrun with wreaths of bronze, pomegranate, throw containing 100. Under the pillars and tops of the were pommels, P-O-M-M-E-L-S, which were great bowls or vessels for use for oil, over which were hung festoon-wise wreaths of pomegranate, interspersed here and there with lilywort. They bore the names of Jachin, J-A-C-H-I-N, and Boaz, which is B-O-A-Z. They were placed in front of the porch leading to the sanctuary. 2 Chronicles 3:15 and 1 Kings 7:15-22, and then 2 Chronicles 4:12-13. This room occupied the space above the holy and most holy places, extending the entire length of the house. It was 60 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, and 10 cubits high. That is 120 feet by 40 by 20. This is gigantic. It restored the many things that King David had decided to the Lord. Here also were the silver and the gold vessels and instruments, and all the dedicated things, such as gifts from allied kings, princes, and potentates, meaning other important senior officials, and all other important personages. It was also the royal treasury where Solomon deposited and from whence he dispersed all things of value. That again is referenced in 1 Kings 6:2. The chambers, these are all sections of humongous and immense grand palace. The chambers round about the temple. A series of chambers surrounded the house on 3 sides, the north, west, and south, and all 3 stories high. The most chamber was 5 cubits, which is 10 feet broad, and the middle one was 6 cubits, which is 12 feet. You see the translation from cubits to feet. And the third or low chamber was 7 cubits, which is 14 feet. So basically, take a cubit and double it. Access to these chambers was meant by a peculiar and secret winding stairway on the south side of the house, from the lower into the middle, and from thence to the upper chambers. These chambers were all finished fine wool and overlaid with pure gold, affording quiet and secluded spots for secret communion with God and for the preparation and proper clothing of the priest, as well as a storage room for the vessels and instruments used in every day in the ritualistic services. And this is referenced in 1 Kings 6:5, 6, 8, and 10. Next item, the holy place. The holy place, or great house, was a double cube, but 40 cubits long and 20 cubits wide and 20 cubits high. That translates into 80 feet long, 40 feet wide, and 40 feet high. This is a high ceiling. It was sealed with the fir tree, overlaid with fine gold and settings of palm trees and chains and engraved cherubim on the walls. The entire house was garnished with precious stones for beauty. The entrance to the house was by a large double door, two leaves to the one door and two leaves to the other, of olive wood carved with cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, all overlaid with pure gold. The furniture of the holy palace, this holy place, consisted of 10 candlesticks of pure gold, 5 on the right side and 5 on the left, together with their lamps and snuffers. Also, 10 tables with pure gold, 5 on the right side and 5 on the left, together with their bowls, basins, spoons, and covers. These must be added to the gold altar of incense and its censer, which is C-E-N-S-E-R, the table of shew bread, which is H-E-W-B-R-E-D, and the golden candlestick of the tabernacle. Tabernacle is T-A-B-E-R-N-A-C-L-E. All harmoniously arranged within the walls. Excuse me. Within the walls, ceilings and floors of gold set with precious stones. Again, this is referencing 1 Kings in the Bible, 7:14, and 2 Chronicles, 4:8. The most holy place. The Holy of Holies was a perfect 40-foot cube, which was 20 cubits broad and 20 cubits long and 20 cubits high. So it's a perfect one. And that's, you just double it, and that's 40 by 40 by 40. All the walls round about were carved with figures of cherubs, palm trees, open flowers, gold. Even the floor was overlaid with gold, and all was garnished with precious stones for beauty. The two doors leading to this most holy place were of olive wood, fully carved with the cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, and overlaid with pure gold. Each door had 2 leaves which folded. Over the entrance hung the veil of blue, purple, crimson, and all the finest fabrics, cunningly wrought with cherubims and palm trees and open flowers. This beautiful tapestry defined the entrance to the oracle. The only piece of furniture in the most holy place was the sacred Ark of the Covenant of the Lord, containing the testimony. This was the place within the oracles, shadowed by the wings of the 2 gigantic cherubs of olive woods, overlaid with pure gold. Each cherubim was 10 cubits high, which is 20 feet, with an outspread of wings of 20 cubits, which is 40 feet. And this is referenced in 1 Kings 6:10. And then I have the site where it's at www.phoenix, P-H-O-E-N-I-X, masonry, all run together, masonry.org/history, historypage.htm. And it shows a bit of the JPS, which is a Hebrew to English, Tanaka, which is T-A-N-A-K-H. The Tanakh is pronounced Tanakh, or Tanakh. Also, is the Mikra, which is M-I-K-R-A, is the canon of the Hebrew Bible. This is the foundation. The traditional Hebrew text is known as the Masoretic text, and that's M-A-S-O-R-E-E-I-C. Tanakh is an acronym of the first Hebrew letter of each of the Masoretic texts of 3 traditional subdivisions. They have 3 subdivisions: are the Torah, T-O-R-A-H, which are also known as teachings, as the 5 books of Moses. Nevin, N-E-V-I-P-O-S-T-I-N, is the prophet, and Ketuvim, K-E-T-U-V-I-N, writings. Hence, you have T-A-N-A-K-A. So it's a combination. It's Tanaka. The name Mikra, M-I-K-R-A, means that which is read. It's another Hebrew word for the Tanakh. The book of the Tanakh were passed on by each generation, according to the rabbinic tradition, were accompanied by an oral tradition called the oral books of the Tanakh. And that is the complete set of scrolls consisting of the entire Tanakh. The Tanakh consists of 24 books. It counts as one book: Samuel's, Kings, Chronicles, and Ezra, and then which is N-E-H-E-M-I-A-H, and counts the T-R-E-I as Earth. I don't speak or understand Hebrew. but it's TREIMASAR, which is the 12 prophets, literally 12 as a single book. So you have the Torah, and then you have the main article, which is Pentateuch, and that's Pentateuch. You have the Torah, which is a collection of five books in the law of Moses, commonly referred to as the five books of Moses. Printed versions of the Torah are often called the Chamisha, which is C-H-A-M-I-S-H-A. And it's literally the five sections of the Torah, formerly known as the Chumash, which is C-H-U-M-A-S-H. In Hebrew, the five books of the Torah are identified by the first prominent word in each book. So the first word in each book is called, the five books is the Bereshit, B-R-E-S-H-I-T, and that is from the book of,
and that is mean,
that means the beginning, which is the second book is a Shemot, which is S-H-E-M-O-T, and that translates into names, and that is in the book of Exodus. These are the first word of each one. The third book is the Vayikra, which is V-A-Y-I-K-R-A, and that translates into the word, literally, the word, two words, and he called. So it's an expression, and that's from the book of Leviticus. Then you have the fourth, which is a Bemidbar, which is B-E-M-I-D-B-A-R, Bemidbar, okay. And that translates into, literally, in the desert. That is in the book of Numbers, okay? And the fifth one, to finish off, is the Devarim, which is D-E-V-A-R-I-M. And that translates into, literally, things or words. That's in the book of Deuteronomy. So basically, you have Nevim, which is means to edit, and that's the book of Nevim, which is N-E-V-I apostrophe I-M. They hyphenate words, unlike in English, for in script rather than abbreviations for contractions. They have the former prophets. You have Joshua, the judges of Samuel, kings, and then you have the latter prophets, which is a major. You have Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel. Your three there. Then you have the latter prophets, the 12 minor, and that's Hosea, H-O-S-E-A, Joel, J-O-E-L. You have Amos, A-M-O-S. You have Abadah, which is O-B-A-D-I-A-H. You have Jonah, J-O-N-A-H. Then you have Micah, M-I-C-A-H. Then you have Nahum, which is N-A-H-U-M. You have Habakkuk, which is H-A-B-A-K-K-U-K. And then Zephaniah, which is Z-P-H-A-N-I-H, with Hagel, H-A-G-G-A-L, and Zechariah, which is Z-E-C-H-A-R-I-A-H. And lastly, you have Malachi, M-A-L-A-C-H-I, within the Hebrew Bible. Okay, let's go forward. As I don't speak or read or write Hebraic language, I'm just going with what I can state in English. In this article, it has both. And this is the division includes the books which cover over the time from the entrance of the Israelites into the land of Israel until the Babylonian captivity of Judea, which is the period of prophecy. Their distribution, and that was in quotes, their distribution is not chronological, but substantive. So you have Joshua, then you have Judges, Samuel, Kings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and the 12 minor prophets are all considered one book. Then in another book is you have Hosea, H-O-S-E-A, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, which is O-B-A-D-I-A-H, you have Jonah, J-O-N-A-H, Micah, which is M-I-C-A-H, Nahum, which is N-A-H-U-N, and then you have Habakkuk, which is H-A-B-A-K-K-U-K. Then you have Zephaniah, which is Z-P-H-A-N-I-A-H. Haggai, which is H-A-G-G-A-I. Zechariah, which is Z-E-C-H-A-R-I-A-H. And Malachi, which is M-A-L-A-C-H-I. And then you have the Ketuvim, which is a main article, the books of the Ketuvim, the three poetic books, the Psalms, Proverbs, Jobs, Psalms, these are the other ones, Palms, Proverbs, Job. You have the five Megillot, which I'm not familiar with, Megillot, which are the translates into scrolls. You have the Songs of Ruth, and you have Lamentations, and you have Esther, and Ecclesiastes, which is Ecclesiastes. The other books are Daniel, Ezra, and Nehemiah, which is Nehemia, and then you have Chronicles, and then Ketuvim, which is Ketuvim, and that is Writings translated, which consists of 11 books. Scribe below. Then we have the image that he posted there. That's giving you a background that it's founded upon ancient Hebrew. But now we're going to go over the portion where this proves that it was truly that Scotland, Edinburgh, Scotland. Edinburgh consists of two words. Edin is the earlier spelling of, which is known as Eden, E-D-E-N. And Burg is Germanic, and that is city or town. Anyway, so this shows the image of the different crests that are posted above. It says the Kingdom of Israel in this image, which is the Hebrew nation of Scotland. And it shows the 2, 4, 10 right there, surrounded by the Jewish stars. Anyway, Star of David. So in the images, I'll have to blow this one up to an extent. It's fascinating to see what Brandon Michael Keyes did as far as research over years. Southern Scotland is the real and correct location for the region known as Mesopotamia that we were taught is between the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers in Iraq today. However, the real one is in Scotland. And when you see on the images that Dennis is portraying, you'll realize that this is absolutely factual. That Mesopotamia is where the real locations of the ancient kingdom of Canaan, which is C-A-N-A-A-H-A-A-N, Assyria, Israel, Babylon, and Ur, which is U-R, which is Mesopotamia, is located at all in the borders and boundaries of southern Scotland. That is where the true biblical location for the ancient kingdoms are located. They originally were in Scotland, not the Middle East. Here's the map of the 12 tribes of Israel, all inside the borders on the boundaries of Scotland. Judea, this map here shows that the sections and divisions were all laid out in the different regions of Scotland. The Hyperborean Hebrews, which was the and the Atlantean Israelite tribes, are known as Reuben, R-E-U-B-E-N, Simon, S-I-M-E-O-N, Levi, L-E-V-I, Judah, J-U-D-A-H, Dan, D-A-N, Naphtali, which is N-A-P-H-A-T-I, A-L-I rather, Gad, G-A-D, Asher, A-S-H-E-R, Ishar, which is I-S-S-A-C-H-A-R, Zebulun, which is Z-E-B-U-L-U-N, Joseph, which is J-O-S-E-P-H, and Benjamin, B-E-N-J-A-M-I-N. All laid out in the Scottish landscapes with the mountains of Scotland and the valleys of Scotland as well. All of the 12 tribes of Israel were, in fact, located in Scotland, right inside the Scottish territories. The mountains and the valleys themselves, Reuben, Simon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, Ishar, Zebulun, Joseph, and Benjamin. I have been trying to tell people that the real city of Jerusalem and the Hebrew Israelite kingdom were always located in the country of Scotland today. Edinburgh, Scotland is the real prehistoric, ancient, quote, biblical city of Jerusalem. The entire story of this Bible does not originate from the Middle East. It originates from the ancient prehistoric Scotland. Even the true Israelites, the Scottish Milesians, which is M-I-L-E-S-I-A-N-S, are not from the Middle East. They are part of the Western tribes of Aryans. Aryan is A-R-Y-A-N-S, who splintered off into their own groups and or tribes, but they are also originated from the kingdom of Thule, T-H-U-L-E, which was originally Atlantis. Both King David and his son, King Solomon, were red-haired. Red hair is mentioned that it is descriptive of David and his family, and that they were fair-haired and fair-skinned, which states right there. This was most of the description of the rest of the ancient Hebrew and Israelites themselves. The city that is so-called the Middle East is not the real city of Jerusalem, whereas the city is not the real holy and sacred city of the ancient biblical Israel. This city is not the true and holy sacred city of the Hebrew scriptures. This is none other than a fake fabricated city created by Rome, and the Roman Empire itself is an embodiment of lies and deceit over the eyes of the world for millennia. And then it shows a map that the people can see so they get familiarized. I will like to blow this up so you can see it in larger script, but it's excellent because it shows that Mesopotamia was actually in, you can read the different towns and the city-states. You have Judea, which Judah was in the southeastern portion of Scotland, Sinai, S-I-N-A-I. Above it, Moab is above that on the eastern side. It's just absolutely fascinating, but everything absolutely matches up to the letter. And you can see it with the overviews pictures that are coming up from the air, aerial views. Edinburgh, Scotland is a real city and holy, sacred, and biblical city of Jerusalem. Okay. It is a known secret fact, a suppressed fact, that the ancient biblical Edinburgh, Scotland is where the true lands of the Bible is located, as southern Scotland is where the real ancient biblical and ancient Hebrew Israelite kingdom of Israel was situated at. Excuse me. The city in the Middle East is not the Jerusalem. It is all fake. It's a Roman fabrication and a total copy of Edinburgh, Scotland. And that's what I'm pointing out, audience. This is literally a replication of what exists today in Edinburgh, Scotland, and where the real whole city and sacred city of Jerusalem is, and also King Solomon's Temple. Scotland, Ireland, and England are the ancient biblical history of the British Isles, where the true history, the true story of the Bible took place. I'm going to take a sip of iced tea. One moment. Ginger ale. Okay. Scotland is the land of Canaan, Israel, and Mesopotamia. It is the real location of the Kingdom of Israel. Edinburgh is the real city of Jerusalem, and southern Scotland is where the land of Canaan is located. It is where the Promised Land is situated, and where the ancient Hebrew Israelite kingdom and civilization of Israel all started. I am planning to take a trip to Edinburgh, Scotland, in 2017, from where he is, will prove that Arthur's Seat is the Mount of Olives, and Edinburgh Castle and its moat is, in fact, the real Temple Mount, the Holy Road, which is H-O-L-Y-R-O-O-D, which is Holy Rood Palace, is where the house and the palace of King Solomon's truly once stood. I'm a firm believer that all of the eastern mounds that are dotted around Ireland and Scotland happen to be the real tombs of the biblical patriarchs and biblical matriarchs, meaning the male and female, of the Bible. Both King David and King Solomon's tombs, I believe, are in Edinburgh, Scotland, and that is where I believe they were entombed. And he can do surveys, but he will go. It must take a licensed and degreed archaeologist, and ones that are only prominent than actually could ever possibly be able to create an excavation whereby they could dig up the purported tombs, which I believe is true as well. And that will never happen because the deep state will stop everything to show the truth that of this, where that King Solomon and the temple of is actually in Edinburgh, Scotland. Everything matches up. You have the pillar of fire. The next image is which was high above the Holy of Holies, and this is the Ark of the Covenant was placed inside. It was located inside that temple. Then the next image shows that from an aerial view, how Arthur's Seat is the real Mount of Olives, and that Edinburgh, Scotland is, in fact, the one and only true city of Jerusalem. And you can see it from the aerial views that Dennis is showing now. Edinburgh Castle is the real Temple Mount itself. Everything we've been taught in life, 99.9%, is a combination of lies, deceptions, disinformation, cover-ups, false truth, and treachery. And this is all to do with power. Life is based on, our civilization is based on three concurrent principles. That is control, which equals power, greed, which equals wealth, and conquest, which equals land and territory ownership or acquisition. And then the deep state had added the fourth one, which is known as Zionism, and that is Luciferian. That is horrific. So it is going forward. It is therein suggested that the ancient Merovians, okay, and that's Merovingians, wandered the planet, but that the origins of the Jews may well be rooted in the Scottish Atlantean mystery. We will do another one on Scotland, showing that Atlantis, when it collapsed 12.5 to 13,000 years ago, which is buried under tons and tons of rubbles in the Atlantic Ocean in the north. When it collapsed, the survivors came to the Northern Isles of Scotland and the Northern Isles of Ireland. And that is the foundation which began the next regeneration or transition of the actual civilization today. Our civilization has gone up and down over countless times. And this is a reoccurrent because it's based on those three principles: power, greed, and conquest, literally. So after the deluge, the ruling of the Aryans returned. These people were known historically as the people of the cat. The lion rampant is in their symbol today. And lions are obviously their feline. So the popular flag of Caledonia, Scotland, is also the king of the Norway. Also anciently that the countries and part of the Atlantean Thule. Thule is T-H-U-L-E. And Edinburgh has a Sphinx-like hill that was later called Arthur's Seat. Okay, this is reference to King Arthur, which looks like a lion crouched, was also known as the City of the Lion. The patron saint of Edinburgh is David. That should tell the people. This is why it was. Everything is in reverse as far as what we've learned in history. Atlanteans was a golden age when the evil corrupt priesthood class meddled with crystalline technology, which destroyed their entire civilization. Crystalline is very powerful. It's used in hyper lasers as well as storage of knowledge, memory, and anyway. They destroyed it, and these are the survivors. So that we'll go into that at a later date. So going further is that it is pointed out that by the authors, the biblical references to Jerusalem refer to a fertile land full of mines, minerals, and crops with a seaport called Joppa, which is J-O-P-P-A. That it fits exactly the locality of Edinburgh, not this Jerusalem in Palestine today, which is a very distant port called Jaffa, J-A-F-F-A. But look at the comparison. Joppa is J-O-P-P-A, and Jaffa is J-A-F-F-A, which is a correlation, but the original one is in Scotland, and whose only extract in a barren land may be salt or potash. Given the history favors the victor, and that's how we know it. History always favors the victor. And history is written by the victor, not the defeated. That sometimes, sure, that must have gone real wrong to make us all think that the things we now think about Jerusalem and about history today, it's all rewritten and it's an error. Indeed, there exist the chains of forts called the Catrals, which is C-A-T-R-A-L-L, R-A-I-L. And this is almost exactly 80 miles. the people of the cat, or the Gadeni, which is G-A-D-E-N-I, or which later became the Gad, G-A-D, were the ruling tribe of the Jews, and the entire fertile area of Edinburgh, and the Lothians, which is L-O-T-H-I-A-N-S, was populated by some 1 million people then, a place which was biblically recorded to be the hub of a civilization. Today, all the Roman signposts have been defaced and deleted, for something terrible happened in Edinburgh. At a time of serious instability in the Roman Empire, the Jews of the tribe of Gad, the Silurians, which is S-I-L-U-R-I-N-S, revolted, and the retribution from Rome was terrible indeed. There was a massacre of somewhere between 80 to 100,000 people by the legions, and the emperor ordered that not a stone remain standing, and salt be placed on put on the earth over it. And then you have an aerial view showing Arthur's Seat is a real Mount of Olives. You can see the royal palace of King Solomon to the left on the image, aerial view. And Edinburgh Castle is a real Temple Mount that is referenced today in Israel, but it's not. It is in Scotland. This is Edinburgh, Scotland. You can see the castle there, which is the original city of Jerusalem. The public has no conception that this aspect, where the true history came from, the foundation of, as I mentioned, Western civilization is only from the Irish and Scottish, English, British Isles. And that is what the public has never been taught and is only learning now. So then you can see the other aerial view that Dennis has posted. And it talks about this person. I read one of his books. He's passed away. His name was Commons Beaumont. And I believe he lived from about 1831 to like 1901, somewhere in that range. But Commons Beaumont book, details the map of Edinburgh and Jerusalem as it was then. The citadel being Edinburgh Castle today, on the impregnable rock of the three pointed side, is more ably confirms to the biblical descriptions that our current understanding of the citadel in Jerusalem in Palestine. The Dung Gate, which is D-U-N-G, gate, corresponds with the Cow Gate in Edinburgh today. The Temple Mount on the Way of God is Edinburgh's Royal Mile. At the Temple Mount, there stands St. Giles Cathedral and a commemorative heart in the cobblestones outside, which signify the heart of the Lothians, L-O-T-H-I-N-S. Opposite St. Giles on the Temple Mount, the law courts, the courts of law, and one of the oldest Masonic lodges also stands near the Royal Mile, whilst the Mount of Olives was Arthur's Seat. Golgotha, which is G-O-L-G-A-O-T-H-A, was Gogar, G-O-G-A-R, and Holyrood, H-O-L-L-Y-R-O-O-D, Palace, and the Palace of the Cedars, and that's a tree, C-E-D-A-R-S, and Joppa, which was a seaport, has always been a port of Edinburgh. And now in Israel, it's called Jaffa, J-A-F-F-A. But it is a direct correlation because the original one was here. And this is what the deep state does not want the public to know, that history has been absolutely rewritten and has been edited to conform to what they want it written as. So, the broad estuary upon the Edinburgh stands the city of the Lion, which is of the Gad tribe, G-A-D, of the sovereign tribes of the Jews. It is called the Firth, F-I-R-T-H, Firth of Forth, which sounds rhythmic, but it's F-O-R-T-H. And it translates as the Way of Ways. And this crossing of a broad estuary at Jerusalem is noted in the Bible, with Pontius, P-O-N-T-I-U-S, which you know as Pontius Pilate, P-I-L-A-T-E, stands just north of the Roman fort chain, which fenced the area in like some ancient ghetto comprised of the one of the richest and most powerful hubs of civilization in the ancient world, with its lead and silver mines, its fertile lands, and its rich people. Rich in people as well, not just wealthy. It was very populated. Scottish Jerusalem was a powerful place. It is recorded that the King David, on the run from the Solomon, from Solomon rather, consulted a seer, meaning an oracle or a soothsayer, as a seeker of a seer of Gad, Enbru, and that he had many names, Kaer Eden, which is Kaer Eden, Dun God, that's Dungad, a lot of this is difficult for me to pronounce, Giudi hyphen Al hyphen Guarth, which would be Gudai al Gwarth, of the Jewish Gad, Chenonia, which is a place of chaos, and that's Chaonia, meaning place of chaos. In 134 AD, the Jews proclaimed a new Messiah, and that Messiah was Bar hyphen Coch-Eba, Bar Kochiba, son of the star, and the chief rabbi appointed him the king of the Jews. A coin was minted honoring him, being horsed with a crown, and on the reverse side was a thistle. Thistle is the symbol of Scotland. The coin symbolizes the first year of redemption. Okay, that's the end of that article. How are we doing on time? Go ahead. This article is over on part one. Dennis?
Yeah, I think we've probably done enough to be going on with. We're about an hour and a quarter in.
Okay. So you can lead on, or however you want to continue with the end of your time.
Yeah, it's
absolutely fascinating that we've always been taught wrong intentionally because it's all about power, greed, and conquest. This is the truth, and it's just so fascinating to be that the British and Irish Isles are the true foundation of Western civilization, and that Scotland hosts the original Jerusalem and King Solomon's Temple. That is, to me, was stunning. I have other parts of his work. There's a part two, and I've done updates to his as well. So depending on what the audience's response is, we can continue with that next week. Over.
Yeah, we'll just play it by ear, Chris. I think that the best way to do it is try and keep the shows to about an hour or an hour and a quarter. That's kind of my plan, because otherwise it gets too long and there's too much information for people to take in.
Were you able to show the images on your platforms?
I did on the live stream on YouTube. I was showing the images as you were going through. They weren't all lined up with what you were saying, but all the images got shown.
That's fine, but at least they were able to see the actual images. And the aerial views are classic, that they absolutely prove that Jerusalem was the city of Edinburgh, and without question. Okay, I'll let you continue. Over.
I think I'm just going to wrap up at that point, Chris, because it's as I say, we're moving on for time. So I just want to thank you for coming in and sharing your research.
I have so much work to share with our audience, and I know that a lot of people will be coming over from the North America on your show. So I'll let you continue.
All right, that's fine. I think I was going to play a little bit of Webster Tarpley to take us out.
Great.
This is from years ago, but he always has something interesting to say. I always learn something from Webster Tarpley. So just 5 minutes of this to take us out, and then we'll call it a day.
Fair enough. Okay. I'll listen.
What I think we can do is not to try to describe everything that happened in history, but at least to give the outlines of one side of it, that is to say, the oligarchical side, the side of organized evil. When we talk about oligarchism, everybody's aware we're talking about this notion of an irrational principle of domination, some kind of feudal aristocracy that says we are destined to rule, we're a higher species of humanity than others, and therefore they have to obey. You're talking about usury. You're talking about monetarism. You're talking about the rule of families and or fundi and or various kinds of priesthood, and we'll see examples of all of that as we go along. This principle. Now, I wanted to start by formulating a paradox which I think really is a paradox. It really is, if you think about it, an astounding fact, although I guess we have become inured to it. If you look at these documents from the United Nations bureaucracy, especially this United Nations Development Agency, or whatever they call themselves, the UNDH, whatever it is, development, and where they go through their apparatus of world government and their world court with the subpoena powers and their international financial apparatus and their international economic warfare bureau and all of these other things, if you compare that to the decrees and edicts of the Roman Emperor Diocletian about 300 AD, you will find that the spirit, and not only the spirit, but actually quite a number of the details behind these things are exactly the same. And how can it therefore be that supposedly in the culminating moment of the 20th century, the end of the second millennium, right after 2,000 years of Christianity, supposedly, that the main organisms of world public opinion, as they would say, the United Nations and everything that goes with it, is able to come up with a monstrous plan so similar to that of Diocletian, and if implemented, something that would indeed bring on what Diocletian did, a new dark age, which in the case of Diocletian, remember, lasted 500 years, a long night of the collapse of the worst collapse of civilization that we've seen in the West.
All right, so that's pretty much the end of the show now. Thanks for coming in, Chris, and we'll call that a day, and we'll set something up for next week or maybe a couple of weeks' time, see how we go.
I'm available.
Yeah, we'll do one a week for a while and then take a break for a couple of weeks and then do another run every week.
Okay.
Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it. And I'll see you. And I'll speak to you at some point during the week, no doubt.
We can do a Zoom chat next time if you wish. Okay.
Yeah, no problem at all. All right.
Catch you later. Thank you so much. Over and out.